Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, technology is changing almost every industry, including fashion. Imagine wearing a computer in the form of clothing, like a jacket. Now, it is possible. The clothing manufacturer Levi Strauss & Company partnered with technology company Google to create what is being called a smart jacket. The word smart is often used to describe actions controlled by a computer. What makes this jacket smart is washable technology added to the cuff, the cloth encircling the wrist. Ivan Puparev heads the smart clothing project for Google.
When somebody calls you, your jacket vibrates and gives you light to know that somebody calling you.
A touch on the cuff can provide directions for helping you get to where you need to go. The jacket also can play music when combined with a mobile phone, headphones, and a small piece of removable computer hardware. The Levi's smart jacket can be purchased on the internet for $350. It is just one step to smarter clothing. Puparev explained that Google plans to use the technology for any kind of clothing. He added that the company is working with other partners in the fashion industry to help make their products connected. From how clothes are used to how they are made, computing power is reshaping the fashion industry. Designers can create structures and designs that have never existed before current technology. New technologies are also being used to make bioengineered materials made with yeast cells in a laboratory. Suzanne Lee is Chief Creative Officer of Modern Meadow. She explained how her company creates leather-like material from yeast cells. She said, "We engineer them to produce collagen, which is the same natural protein that you find in your skin or an animal skin. Then we really grow billions of those cells, make a lot of collagen, purify it, and then assemble it into whatever kinds of materials the designers that we're working with would like to see." Lee added that these bioengineered materials can be described as both natural and man-made. Technology is also changing popular fashion. The rise of social media means it is not just designers who decide the latest looks in fashion. Artificial intelligence can now collect information from social media and the internet to help designers understand what the public likes.
A home invader is holding a woman hostage in her bedroom. A police officer immediately starts shouting commands, ordering the man to let the woman go. But the invader refuses and uses a weapon in his hand to attack the police officer. The officer then raises her gun and shoots the man. The officer in this training exercise was a British woman on a visit to Las Vegas, Nevada. The imaginary victim and criminal were on a life-size video image inside the city's mob museum. The visitor was taking part in a new hands-on exhibit. Museum workers arm visitors with a gun that shoots plastic balls and puts them in situations similar to those that police face in real life. The Mob Museum opened in 2012. Its official name is the National Museum of Organized Crime and Law Enforcement. For years, the courthouse-turned-museum has told about organized crime and criminal groups, like the American Mafia, also called the Mob. But visitors now can also learn about the complexity of the decisions that police officers face when they react to real-life situations. Some crises may require the use of deadly force. Parts of the Mob Museum were recently remodeled. The building now has an interactive crime laboratory and even a speakeasy area. Almost a century ago, sales of alcohol were barred across the United States. A speakeasy was a place where alcoholic drinks were sold illegally during this period, a time known as Prohibition. The Use of Force exhibit walks visitors through video and live role-playing events, including a meeting with a suspicious person played by an actor. Museum goers are given a police duty belt and a gun that is as heavy as one police officer's carry. Visitors first watch a video presentation by a Las Vegas police officer and are then invited to a brief target shooting exercise. Museum workers tell about gun safety, rules for use of force, and methods used by police. Visitors learn to keep a distance from a suspect, not to keep their finger on the gun's trigger, and not to shoot someone who does not appear to be a threat. Visitor Leslie Morris of London said, "It did feel real. It was the first time I ever held a gun. It was really informative. We don't have guns or anything like that in England." Morris added that her heart rate went up as she walked through the exhibit. In the case of the home invasion, visitors see a video. It shows a homeowner informing police that someone has entered the home. Visitors at that point start acting like the officer and begin to see the inside of a home. "Police," they are told to shout to announce themselves. The video then shows the bedroom with a man holding a woman. Pictures hanging outside the exhibit explain the use of force policies and methods used by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. They also provide an official count of deaths resulting from police use of force nationwide. Las Vegas Police Captain Robert Plummer says he hopes the exhibit will educate and change some people's ideas on what police face when it comes to using deadly force. Plummer told the Associated Press, "A lot of people wonder, why didn't you shoot the gun out of his hand or shoot him in the ankle?" If you visit the exhibit, he added, You will learn that it is nearly impossible to do because there are so many issues to consider. You have to understand your situation. So, if you miss shooting at the elbow, what is behind it? He asked. Is it an innocent citizen standing back there? Is it a child? Or is it someone else? In another part of the Mob Museum, visitors try to identify bullets that were fired from the same gun. They also can see pictures of a real crime scene from 2016 and things that would be collected at a scene. People can play the role of medical examiner. A video screen shows images of bodies, and visitors are told to answer a series of questions to try to identify the cause of death. The cases are based on the deaths of famous mobsters. And below it all, people interested in learning more about Prohibition or just looking to have fun can visit a working speakeasy in the museum. The exhibit explains in detail how organized crime took steps to make, move, and sell alcohol during the 1920s. People can test a number of current and Prohibition-era drinks. People want experiences, said Jonathan Allman, museum president and CEO. This allows us to take them back in time. I'm Katie Weaver.
Scientists in Britain and the United States have designed a substance that eats plastic. They believe that, in the future, it could help reduce pollution. The enzyme is able to break down polyethylene terephthalate, or PET. This form of plastic was patented in the 1940s. It is now used in millions of metric tons of plastic bottles. PET plastics can remain in the environment for hundreds of years. The plastics pollute large areas of land and water around the world. Researchers from Britain's University of Portsmouth and the U.S. Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory made the discovery. They did so while examining the structure of a natural enzyme that is thought to have evolved in a waste recycling center in Japan. John McGeehan, a professor at Portsmouth, co-led the work. He said the researchers found that the natural enzyme was helping a bacteria break down PET plastic. So, the researchers decided to make small changes to its structure by adding some amino acids. This led to a valuable change in the enzyme's actions. It made the enzyme's plastic-eating abilities work more quickly. We've made an improved version of the enzyme better than the natural one already, McGeehan told the Reuters News Service. He added that it may be possible for them to make more improvements to it in the future. The journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences published the team's findings earlier this month. The team is now trying to make it possible for the enzyme to be able to break down much larger amounts of PET plastics. McGeehan said, "It's well within the possibility that in the coming years, we will see an industrially viable process to turn PET and potentially other plastics back into their original building blocks so that they can be sustainably recycled. Independent scientists not directly involved with the research said the discovery was interesting, but they warned that the enzyme's development as a possible solution for pollution was still in the early stages. Oliver Jones is a chemistry expert at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology University. He told Reuters that enzymes are not harmful to humans and other animals. They easily break down in natural conditions. Also, extremely small organisms can produce them in large amounts. There is strong potential to use enzyme technology to help with society's growing waste problem by breaking down some of the most commonly used plastics, Jones said. Douglas Kell is a professor of biological science at Manchester University. He said further rounds of work should be expected to improve the enzyme yet further. He added that the discovery brings the goal of creating man-made, sustainably recyclable chemical substances much closer to reality. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury, and this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. He asked that his name not be put before the convention. He met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth president of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, "We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system."
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick. When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, "I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now."
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. "When I came to power," Harrison said, "I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election."
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.